It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Zena Nawas. She is an assistant professor of dermatology at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. She is currently the director of the transplant patient services and the director of the cosmetic and laser department. Please welcome Dr. Nawas.
Hello, hello again. Again, I'm super excited to be here with you. And now we are switching gears from botulinum toxin to high-risk tumors. Let's do this. And this is going to be like a crash course, you guys. This is everything I've learned during my training. Bam, in 1 hour. Let's do it. So, first thing is our bread and butter of dermatology, skin cancer, basal cell carcinoma. So, most common skin cancer, it accounts of 80% of all skin cancer. And it begins in this real, really beautiful basal layer down here. So this is where it originates. But it's a very nice, slow-growing tumor. It usually takes years and years to grow. It usually happens in patients in their 60s and 70s, but for sure can happen earlier. It usually happens with patients who are really fair, like red hair, blue eyes, those beautiful people. But sorry, you're getting those skin cancers. But now, the most important thing I want you to know from this slide is this is the UV exposure, is this intermittent intense exposure. So you remember your days on the beach, if you got a sunburn, bam, that's it. Like, it's like that one intense sunburn. This is what you really usually causes those basal cell carcinoma. And indoor tanning, I don't know why they're still there. Like, seriously, why do we still have indoor tanning? Not sure. And then all the ionizing radiation, the UV exposure, and definitely so many chemicals. Immunosuppression is a big one. So it's the 5 to 10 times increased chance for these patients with the organ transplants. So it's usually happens in this skin that has a lot of sebaceous skin, or sorry, sebaceous glands and follicles. And it's most likely due to the UVB. So B for burn, that's how I remember it. And that's what's causing really this, the sun damage and the skin cancer. And nearly all basal cells shows an activation of this Hedgehog signaling pathway. When I was in training, this used to confuse the hell out of me. I was like, I have no idea what this means, but I'm going to make it really, really simple. And we're going to go through it. But know that 2/3 of the basal cell is caused by mutation in patch 1, and the second most common is the P53. Okay, this is it. You guys, we're here. So now, normal, we have a patch protein here. This patch is actually asking another protein called smoothen, like, hey, stop, you are not going to work. If smoothen works, then all the signaling pathways activated, and this is how we're going to get the skin cancer. Why we're even talking about this? Because now all the systemic medications that we're going to talk about is actually targeting this part. So again, patch is the police that's asking smoothen, do not work. And when the skin cancer happens, like, there's something that happens there. Either we have a ligand on the patch that's asking patch not to work anymore, or the smoothens, there is a mutation that's causing activation to the smoothen. And this is where all, like, the magic happens with the systemic. We're going to go through it in more details. But just remember this part here. Okay. Luckily, basal cell is really not one of the high-risk cancers, but it can be. But luckily, it's like less than 0.1% of all the basal cell metastasize. And those metastasize usually are humongous, like more than 7.5 centimeters, and usually on the head and neck. When they metastasize, most likely they're going to the lymph nodes, but the second most common area is the lungs. And usually when that happens, it's like, bam, doom, like 10 months. Usually the patient dies, unfortunately, but remember now we have really nice systemic medications. So I guess it's the time to have skin cancers, I guess. No. We're going to talk about how to prevent it too. So clinical presentation, most of the times it's on the face. Again, because we're getting most of our sun damage on our face, but 15% of it is also on the trunk. Very rarely do we get it in areas that does not see the sun, and the areas that do not have the oil glands and the hair follicles. Now, these are the three most common ones. It's not the only ones, but those are the most common ones. So starting with the nodular, this is what we see day in and day out in dermatology. It's like those cute pearly papules. It has a lot of telangiectasia. On dermoscopy, and I know there was a lecture about it, I'm sure we talked about the arborizing blood vessels there. And sometimes ulceration happens like in the middle of this papule. Now the superficial one, it's less common, it's 15%. For some reason, men get it more than women, and usually it's on the trunk. It's it looks like really like dried skin, like whatever. And what I also tell my residents is when there is something that's pink, you stop and think. So usually when it's scaly, it's pinkish, don't ignore it. Don't ignore it. Usually it's something. So it looks like dry skin with a pink background. Now, this is what we're going to talk more about because this is the high-risk one. The morpheiform infiltrative basal cell. Those are the skin cancer that keeps me up night. Oh, my goodness. So, luckily, it's only 5 to 10%. And it's usually, it looks like atrophic skin, like a scar. So, and we see a lot of it, like what looks like a scar on a nose. And I saw it a lot initially when I was in training. I was like, I didn't know what it is. I thought it was literally just a scar. But usually it has this pink color. Again, stop and think, biopsy it. Most likely it's going to be like one of those bad skin cancer, the infiltrative one. And usually it has very ill-defined border. Those are the ones when the patient comes to my clinic and we're doing Mohs surgery, when I know the diagnosis is infiltrative, I'm like, sir or ma'am, you're going to be with me all day, most likely. Because a lot of the times we don't see it clinically. What we see is literally just a tip of an iceberg, and then our microscope is helping me figure out where those roots are going. And those are the ones that, unfortunately, I go to stage 3, 4, 5. I'll tell you my nightmare. One of them went 7 stages, and for the life of me, I couldn't clear it. It was 6 p.m. at that time. My histotech was like, Dr. Nawaz, I need to pick up my daughter. I was like, I gotta go. And the patient came the next day, and again, I couldn't clear him. Like 4 stages later, the patient's like, I'm done. He had a lot of radiation, immune suppression, but luckily at the end, it was all just superficial that I was able to give imiquimod, and we're following up closely. But those are nightmares, seriously. Now, let's talk about the high-risk basal cell carcinoma. If it's on the trunk, I would worry if it's more than 2 centimeters. Now, the face, not every single part of our face is a high-risk area. The high-risk area is what here, you can see it in blue, what we call the mask areas. So around the eye, the temples, and around the mouth. Usually cheek and forehead, we're okay. We call it area M, so like moderate risk. What you see here is the H area, which is high-risk area. So poorly defined is also a big one. Recurrence, of course, is also a really not a good sign. And immune suppression, again, like their body, they don't have the immunity to fight these. Site of prior radiation. And then when we talk about subtype, again, remember the aggressive forms, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it, and perineural invasion. So these are the aggressive basal cell. So again, not our beautiful nodular and superficial. So those are infiltrative. And basically they're called infiltrative, like they are really deep in the dermis. Sometimes they go even beyond the dermis. And it has like all these like the roots there that goes on and on and on. So micronodular, what you see on the second picture here. So like very, very tiny ones can be easily missed because sometimes they look like just the hair follicle. So we usually get extra stains when I know where I'm dealing with a high risk basal cell. So basal squamous is when there's a combination of what looks like squamous cell and basal cell, like the third picture there. And then this sclerosing one, basically, again, like looks like a scar. Those are the really, really main ones. And they can be in any part. Because sometimes when you see your path reports, it will tell you nodular, but focally infiltrative. I don't know if you've seen any of those, but that, take it seriously. Now, perineural invasion. Nice thing about it, it's very, very rare. If we're going to see it, it's usually in those aggressive forms, and it's only 3 to 10% in the aggressive form of the basal cell. Now, why do we worry about it? So once the nerve gets involved, and look at this beautiful photo. So this is our nerve here in the center, and the basal cell is literally attacking it all around it. So when that happens, it's going to increase the risk of local recurrence and will increase the risk of metastasis. So this is a very high risk. So now when we see those in our clinic, so what do we do? Most important, first step will be surgery. Now, surgery, there's multiple ways. I'm a Mohs surgeon. I'm biased like Mohs. It's like the best thing on earth. But Mohs, I'll show you the difference, and we'll come back to this. So let's start with the excision. So basically, when we just do a regular excision, and let me start. If you're going to do an excision for something that's high risk, you're going to take a wider margin. Usually, our normal margins is like 4 millimeters. But when we're dealing with high risk, you need to take a little bit more, so 6 millimeter at least. But then you send it to your pathologist. The pathologist will do this, like bread loafing or meat loafing. So just part of the specimen is being checked. And really, like in best case scenario, only 1% of the margin is checked this way. So I definitely won't do a regular excision for high risk tumor. You will definitely miss something, and it will recur. Now, what Mohs surgery is? So Mohs surgery is we're checking 100% of the margin. We're checking all the outside margin and then the deep margin. And I have this photo. I couldn't find like any better one just to show all the different process of our day. But basically, we start with removing between 1 to 2 millimeters around the area that looks clinically abnormal. From there, it goes to the lab. There's multiple ways to do it. Each surgeon has their own style. I like to keep my piece like one. I love the one. Some people do it bisected in 2 pieces, and some do it like in 4 pieces. But also it depends on how big it is. And then we lay it down. We do all these beautiful nicks. We get it all the way down. The histotechs do their magic. Usually it takes like 20 minutes, like if it's a straightforward case. And then we check it under the microscope, and you literally can see everything. And then if there's anything remaining, you're going to know exactly where it is on the skin of the patient. You go back and take just there. So with the Mohs surgery, not only we're checking 100% of the margin, but we're literally preserving as much of the normal skin as possible. So now in places that do not have Mohs surgery, you can do other ways, but still checking it with basically like slow Mohs. You do it, and it's called CCMPD. Basically, you're like doing the complete margin assessment, but you're not doing it in your clinic. You're doing it in a lab. So you do the same thing, but it takes days, basically. And then from there, so now we did the surgery, but then when do we do radiation for basal cell carcinoma? Usually, you always try to do definitely the surgery. But for non-surgical candidates, you can do the radiation. The 5% or 5-year cure rate is actually not bad. It's like 92%. It has a lot of side effects. Most importantly, the acute skin toxicity there and alopecia. If it's on the nose or the ear, sometimes cartilage necrosis can happen. And then, like that patient that I mentioned to you, he actually had radiation before, and now he developed a new basal cell that I tried to treat. But sometimes those secondary malignancy are nasty when patients have radiation. So just keep that in mind. So it's definitely not my first go-to. But if the patient tells me absolutely no surgery, I'm like, okay, let's try the radiation. Now, you can do radiation as an adjuvant treatment. And I'm just going to remind everybody what adjuvants mean. Adjuvant means like you do the radiation after the main treatment is already done. Basically, we do this for the most part, we're doing surgery. So you do the surgery and then you do the adjuvant radiation compared to neoadjuvant. Neoadjuvant when you do it the first step. So again, going back to the adjuvant, I do it if I do the surgery, but still there's positive margins, but could not clear it. So we can do it that way. Or if the patient has extensive perineural invasion, or like even a large nerve like that we can name, like we can know exactly what nerve it's involved, we can do the radiation then. Now, also for like the high-risk patients, we have now amazing systemic medications. There's 3 FDA-approved ones, and 2 of them are the hedgehog inhibitors. Those are called vismodegib and sonidegib. So, or we usually call them Vismo and Sony. Sounds more cool. And then the second one is the PD-1 inhibitor. We're going to talk more about the PD-1 inhibitor too. But the one that is approved for basal cell is the cemiplimab. Let's talk about the Vismo. Vismo, it binds to that to the smoothened. It binds there, and it just actually inactivates it. Because if smoothened is activated, all that pathway is going to be activated, and we're going to develop a basal cell. So it literally binds to it and stop it from working. Now, when do we use it? We use it for 2 indications. If it's metastatic or locally advanced. Okay, so 2 indications. And for the metastatic, the response rate is like in the 40s. And then for the locally advanced, it's a little bit even more, like it's in the 60s. So it's great. And it's actually a pill medication the patient can use. 20% of these patients, unfortunately, will have resistance to this medicine. If they do, then our next step that we can actually jump to the cemiplimab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor. Now, a lot of the patients discontinue this medication because of the nasty side effects that we're going to talk more about. But a lot of it is muscle pain. It's terrible. And they have, like, the taste. They can't even enjoy food anymore. Like, they don't have their normal taste anymore. And then they lose hair. Sony, on the other hand, it actually do the same thing. It binds to the same smoothened and actually asks you to just go to sleep. You are not working right now. But it's only approved for locally advanced. Unfortunately, for the metastatic basal cell on the trial, it's actually called the BOLT trial. For Sony, the response rate was just 7%. So they were like, nope, we're not going to use that. We have our Vismo or cemiplimab when it's metastatic. And it's also a pill that the patient takes just at home, compared to cemiplimab, which basically is an infusion. So now going back to the side effects of these, terrible, terrible taste abnormality, and the muscle pain is unreal. There are certain things that we can ask our patients to take, and some of it is just like the multivitamins and like eating healthier and all of that, but still it's really terrible. Because of like the muscle spasm that they get and muscle pain, we sometimes check the CK just to ensure it's not really getting so high. And here we tell the patients that there's a lot of things that you need to be aware of. So you cannot donate blood for 24 months after you stop the medicine. Male cannot donate the semen during or after 3 months after stopping the medicine, and pregnancy. So category X. Definitely contraception, and the contraception is almost for 2 years after stopping the medicine. So it is serious. But again, like talking, this is like a repeat. Okay, but the prognosis. So not even just for high risk, this is for all our patients. So every time I tell I see the patient for basal cell, I'm like, hey, most likely I will see you again. Unfortunately, I'm happy to see you, but it's just what it is. It's you have like in the next 3 years, there's a 44% chance you're going to develop another one. For the next 5 years, even up to 50% chance that you are going to get another skin cancer. And most likely it will be a basal cell, but any skin cancer can develop. Like basically when I see a patient that has a basal cell cancer, I know that they have enough sun damage to cause any of the other skin cancers that we're going to talk about. And here, usually whenever they have their first skin cancer, I ask them we need to do your full skin check from head to toe every 6 to 12 months for the first 5 years, and then we can go annually if they don't develop any new ones. Now, prevention. So for the patient who have a lot of skin cancer, we can use nicotinamides. Nicotinamide is really over-the-counter. My experience from our patients, when I ask them where they got it, they tell me either from vitamin stores or Amazon. I guess Amazon is my best friend today. and it's actually a form of vitamin B3, but the nice thing about it does not cause flushing. And it's 500 milligram. They take it twice a day, and it decreases pre-skin cancer, so actinic keratosis, by up to 35%, and the other non-melanoma skin cancer up to 23%. So not bad, not bad. So all my patients who are immune compromised, they're actually on it. Switching gears, squamous cell carcinoma. Okay, this is the second most common skin cancer, more than 1 million cases in the USA. And each year there is like 700,000 cases. The lifetime risk for each patient is like 10 to 15%. The metastasis and local regional a disease that occurs in 1 to 5%. And there's 4,000 to 8,000 deaths each year from this squamous cell carcinoma. And the most likely mutation, it's actually the P53. So, again, those fair patients are at risk for the squamous cell carcinoma, men more than women. And usually the older we are, the more prone that we get the squamous cell carcinoma. And patients more than 80 years of age, they have a skin cancer death due to the SCC even more than the melanoma. And now the environmental exposure. So the UV here in this case, this is the cumulative. It's not like this intense one beach visit that you're getting basal cell. This is like the one that you take like long term. And again, the indoor tanning and all the UV radiation. HPV is also a big one for the SCC, and we'll see some photos, and definitely chemicals. Now, this is like what happens when we get the UV radiation. Again, most likely the UVB, a lot of the DNA changes, but most likely what happens is actually it's involving the cyclobutane pyrimidine dimer. Fancy words here, but basically what happens is like there's going to be an uncontrolled proliferation for our keratinocytes. Okay, so more risks. This is actually very interesting. There is multiple new studies to show like what medications that increase squamous cell carcinoma. Thiazide, I have it highlighted because most of our patients are on thiazide. So thiazide not only increases SCC, but even melanomas. So just be cautious. And now those patients that I have that are on thiazide that have a lot of skin cancer, I'm actually talking with the cardiologist or whoever prescribed the thiazide and asking them like, hey, can we try something different? And then the other big ones, basically any medication that can disturb the immune system can cause an increase in the SCC. Now, chronic wounds and inflammation is also a big one, and we'll talk about it a little bit more. But most of the SCC, they're also not that dangerous. We'll talk about the dangerous one. For now, the SCC in situ, it's called Bowen's disease. It's usually when it's only in the epidermal surface, nothing that's going into the dermis. Again, this is the one that looks like dry skin. Again, pink, you stop and think. So this is the one when I'm biopsying these, like what looks like dry skin, really like my differential will be either a superficial basal cell or SCCIS. Like they look very similar to me. They have like certain differences, but very subtle. So I'm like, I have both of them and the pathologists will do their magic. Now, the invasive SCC, there is the well-differentiated, that's like most of our work, but then the moderately differentiated, and then the worst, poorly differentiated. Again, the ones that keep me up at night. The well-differentiated is usually this really nice hyperkeratotic papule, like what we see on the nose over here. Now, the poorly differentiated, it looks like pyogenic granuloma to me, nasty, like absolutely nasty. So it's like this meaty, it's fleshy papule, and you know it's bad. Like, you know it's bad when you see it. Now, these are ones that look bad. They truly look bad when I see that. I was like, oh my goodness, but they're not that bad, really. So the first one is keratoacanthoma, or what we say KA. Now, there are some studies that they say that this is, it's not really an SCC, it's like its own thing. And then there is other studies that says it's like a subtype of this well-diff SCC. Regardless, not a bad skin cancer. A lot of the time they come and they grow super quickly. The patient is like on the phone every day, is like, I need to come in, this thing is growing super fast. And it's true, it grows super fast, but sometimes it actually, the body takes care of it, but not all the cases. So I never tell the patient, oh, go home, your body will take care of it. I'm like, no, let's treat it. Because sometimes they can grow to really bad sizes. And it clinically, it looks like a volcano. Really, it truly does look like a volcano. Now, the other subtype that's also one of the good ones, but look at the photos. They look terrible. Those are the verrucous carcinoma. A lot of the time, they are related to HPV. And there are certain subtypes. The oral fluorite papillomatosis, that white really terrible look on the in the mouth. Luckily, I do not treat them. I send them to head and neck surgeons. And then the anogenital ones are also bad. We'll see more photos of it. And the epithelioma cannulatum. So now, really, I know, right? I know. Oh my God, it looks so painful. So the genital ones, really high risk area. And I've never done a case as big as this one, but I've done a lot on the genital area. But usually when it comes to this, my plan now moving forward, because I've been doing this for 2 years, if this comes to me, I will definitely involve like the urologist with me. I'll definitely involve the oncologist with me, because this is not going to be my easy case of the day. And you can see all the other photos here of, like, for the periungual, like around the nails. Usually all of these are really related to a high-risk HPV, so 16, 18, or even higher. Okay, so why do we even, why are we talking about the high-risk ones? So high-risk ones, there is always a very good chance that this will metastasize. So there's a 2 to 5% chance. And up to 20% of the high-risk SCC will metastasize. So this is serious. So any times we have one of those high-risk features, like I'm always concerned, oncologists are also on board with us, and we'll see like later what we do with them. And there's a high risk for disease-specific death. And here we definitely want to do something that we're going to check all the margins. So the CCP DMA or the Mohs surgery. And usually we're going to need something more than just cutting it out. We're going to need something more. Now these are, for the SCC, all the high risk features and the very high risk features. Same thing here, like the basal cell, like when it comes to the mask areas on the face, the size matters here. So between 2 to 4 centimeter is a high risk, but more than 4 centimeter is a very high risk. Poorly defined, recurrence is always a big one. Immunosuppress is definitely a big one. Rapidly growing, again, rapidly growing, just keep that in mind, like the KA, but sometimes those bad, poorly differentiated SCC can grow quickly, especially in the immune compromised patients. And unfortunately, I have two of these patients in my clinic, very immune compromised. They have like a lung and heart transplant. These tumors grow so quickly. Neurologic symptoms, always ask the patient if there's any neurologic problems. And I will say, like, I recently had a patient who came to me with this recurrent SCC on the cheek. And I was like, okay, fine, we'll do the Mohs, we are all good. And then, like, the question that I, like, I have it in my brain, like, I have, like, this protocol that I go through. I was like, hey, any numbness or tingling? He was like, yeah, for the last few months I've been having tingling on the cheek. I was like, oh, God. So he got an MRI and all the nerve is involved. So now it's not Mohs surgery. It's going to head and neck surgeons. And the patient is going to be on immunotherapy. So always ask this question. And it's serious. It was my first one in 2 years. Pathology for the high risk also, like they're, like the poorly poorly differentiated SCC is always something to know. It's dangerous. The depth. Depth, recently it changed. We used to say like 2 millimeter depth is concerning, but now we know it's at least 6 millimeter, but even more accurately, it's under, like sub-Q. So not just the dermis, like we're beyond the dermis, we're on the sub-Q layer. Perineural invasion, same as what we talked about basal cell, but we see it more often in the SCC here, and we'll talk more about it. And lymphatic and vascular involvement, really rare. I've never seen it, but my colleague have seen quite some of them, but she's been doing it for 30 years. And when you see the pathology, it is intense, seriously. Now, again, just like summarizing everything we talked about, just remember the size. Anytime you see more than 2 centimeter, just like think, okay, like there's more to it. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to refer or no, there's more to it. If it's really deep also, just like think that there's going to be more with this case and everything else that we just discussed here. Now, other high risk locations, ear is a big one. So ear, lips, and the mucocutaneous one, as well as scalp. Every time they're there, I think my heart stops for a moment. I'm like, oh my goodness, did we get it all? Because this is really not, again, one of the things that keep me up at night. Yeah, I'm up at night a lot. Okay. So really, it's more aggressive. They can metastasize, and more often than the other one. So 10 to 30% of these location metastasizes. Okay, these are all SCC that are related to a chronic inflammation. In these two photos, they are related to burns that happened years ago. So those are aggressive, super hard to treat, really poor prognosis for these people, and it can happen with anything, like any inflammatory problems, even in the dermatology. Any of them can develop an SCC. And it's so interesting that it can happen at as early as 6 weeks, but it can also happen as late as 60 years after whatever trauma happened. Oh, and it's called the Margellan ulcer when that happens. Sorry. I'm like, cheese? We all need to smile here. Cheese, everyone. Thank you. Best photo. Oh, goodness. Okay. Now, talking about the organ transplant recipients, those are really like the hard ones. Those are the patients. Remember, like we said, it's like only like 5 to 10 increased chance of basal cell for these patients. This now with the squamous cell are 100 to 200 risk to get an SCC in these patients. And it is true, like every time I see those patients, there is an SCC, either early stages. So my way, because I want to catch them early, I actually see them every 6 weeks. I was like, I'm just going to catch them before they turn into the worst one. So every 6 weeks. So now we eat together with these patients. I was like, just get your lunch. Hey, we're buddies now. Like, I'm going to be really proactive with you. Now, those transplant patients are on a lot of immune suppressant medications. The big one here is the cyclosporin and tacrolimus. If the patients are having a lot of skin cancer on these medications, I actually called the transplant team. And I was like, hey, can we please switch the tacro to the sirolimus? So sirolimus, there is definitely a decreased risk of skin cancer. But for me, it's terrible because if I end up doing a skin, like Mohs surgery, their wound healing is terrible. But I'd rather that than having a lot of skin cancer. So just remember, sirolimus is better for the decreasing the chances of skin cancer, but it does affect the wound healing for sure. And the risk, again, like it makes it more risky in older patients who have a transplant. The duration and the intensity of the immunosuppressant definitely plays a role here. How much UV exposure did the patient had in their life? Does the patient have the high-risk HPV? And again, the fear patients, and if they have history of skin cancer prior to the transplant. And the characteristic for these SCC is they start occurring 30 years earlier. So I do have transplant patients who are in their 20s and 30s that were just doing Mohs surgery for a lot of their SCCs. And a lot of the time, they're multiple. A lot of the time, I'm like calling my schedules like, hey, like just like book as if you have like two patients here because we're going to be there for a while. And also, we need to know that increased risk of recurrence and metastasis in the immune suppressant patients. And they can grow super quickly. I'm telling you, 6 weeks for me is beautiful. I was like, 6 weeks it is. Now, for CLL patients, there's a really nice study here. They compared, okay, it's not the biggest study, but it's very informative. They had 28 patients who have CLL versus 114 matched control. What they found is CLL patients have increased risk for SCC, and then their recurrence with CLL is 24% compared to only 4% in the patients who do not have SCC. So just remember, SCC recurs 7 times more often in CLL patients. Now, talking about PNI, or perineural invasion, very nasty, very, very nasty. But now the diameter of the nerve matters. So this is a beautiful study by Dr. Schmaltz. She studied the diameter of the nerve. What they found is the tumors with large nerve, large is more than 0.1 millimeter, invasion was significantly more likely to have other risk factors, which basically it increases the chance of node metastasis and death from the disease. So when there is like more than 0.1 millimeter, we actually send to radiation. If it's less than that, you don't need to. So 0.1 is key here. Now for staging. So now we know all of these risk factors. Now we need to stage those patients. For SCC, there's two staging, the HECC8 and the Brigham and Women Hospital. This is my favorite, and I'll tell you why. So we'll start with the HECC8. So here, a lot of theirs is, basically, let's start with the T1. It's basically the size, and then T2 just get a little bit bigger. And T3, they lumped so many things together. There was like more than 4 centimeter, a minor bone erosion, perineural invasion, deep invasion. I was like, okay, that's a lot. That's a lot in just T3. And then T4, when it start going to the bone marrow or the skull base invasion. And from my reading, this is actually, they're trying to make it a bit more specific in the coming years. So just be aware of that. This, to me, is a bit more, it gives me a bit more information. So this is what I use for my patients with the SCC. So here we have 4 risk factors. Okay. 4 risk factors. And depending on how many risk factors, we're going to figure out what the T stage is. And T basically stands for the tumor. So if it's more than 2 centimeter, invasion beyond the sub-Q, you remember, we don't even use the 6 millimeter. Like, this is a bit more accurate. Because even 6 millimeter, like, my dermis is going to be different than yours and yours and yours. So sub-Q here is actually way more accurate. Poorly differentiated is the third risk factor, and then perineural invasion if it's more than 0.1. Now, with this, you can figure out what T stage it is. And with this information, just remember the T2B here, okay? T2B is 2 or 3 high risk factors. Now, why this is important? Because this is also another awesome, this is also Dr. Schmidt. This is another study that shows the relationship between the SCC and with the staging. What they found is the people who are in the T2B actually have almost 30% chance that their SCC is gonna metastasize to the lymph nodes. So now, what we know from this, and this is, again, supporting this. Again, almost 30% with the T2B. So now we know any patient who is like the T2B and beyond, they absolutely need some kind of a node study. So we either do the radiology, and so you can do the CT scan, and we can also do the pathology, so just like go for it and do a biopsy. Because again, 30% chance in these cases that they will have it in their nodes. So now, knowing all of this, and we're figuring out the nodes, now how are we going to treat it? Again, most important thing is removing it. Again, with something that we're going to check all the margins. And with this, it will also help us like go further, but I have more details there. Now, when do we give radiation for the SCC? Primary radiation is, again, the patient tells me, and I should put that photo. I have a beautiful photo recently for a patient who has this humongous SCC on her lower leg, and she is like 103 years old. The daughter is there, and she's like my grandma's age. And the daughter is like, hey, no cutting. I was like, I respect that. I was like, sure, I think the lidocaine itself is going to harm you. So this is a patient that I definitely did send to our surgical oncologist colleagues. So again, non-surgical patients. Adjuvant, again, this is when we add it after we are done with the surgery. So we do it if I have positive margins. Like, again, I couldn't clear it, and that's it. I couldn't resect more. I was like, okay, fine. I did as much as I could as a surgeon, and now we're gonna need to add the radiation. Now, if it's negative margin, if I had an awesome day, I cleared the skin cancer, when do I do it? Again, with the PNI. If the PNI is more than the 0.1 millimeter, definitely do it. Or if you can name that nerve, definitely need it. And now with the nodal disease, so after we did all our node exam, if we know that there is a node involved, radiation is also key here. Systemic medications. So for SCC, there's 2 FDA-approved PD-1 inhibitors, and we use it for metastatic SCC and locally advanced that we cannot cure it with the surgery or radiation. So those 2 PD-1, cemiplimab, which we briefly talked about in the basal cell, but I'm going to talk a bit more about it, and pembrolizumab. Again, we call it pembro just because it's cooler. And then PD-1 inhibitors are used as first-line treatment for unresectable metastatic disease, but Remember, we cannot do it with a patient with an organ transplant. You give it to these patients, they are going to reject that organ, and like they will die from that quickly. So just be careful. And I hate that. Like, I do have a patient who absolutely needs a PD-1, but he's a lung transplant patient, but we couldn't do it. We're going to use something that also works. We'll talk more about it, like chemotherapy, but it's not as elegant as the newer immunotherapy. Now you know I love my science here, the basic science, after I start understanding it. So now I'm going to show you this, how this works, the PD-1. So know that the tumors are nasty, absolutely nasty. Look what they do with our skin or our bodies. So the tumor cell here, they have the PD-L1. I remember L for ligand or like lesion, which is the tumor, okay? So PD-L1 is usually on the tumor cells. The PD-1 is on our T cells. When these both attach to each other, this nasty tumor cell actually asks our T cell, hey, you're going to sleep. You are not working anymore. So the T cell is not doing its job. What we do when we do this imiplimab or the Pembro, basically we're just inhibiting this attachment. So if that attachment is not there, bam, our T cells are working and killing those tumors, the SCC. So really simple, really, really simple how it works, but it's brilliant. Okay, now with there is 52% response rate with the unresectable local advanced SCC and 47% response rate with metastatic. So almost like 50% of the cases they will respond. But it has also a lot of side effects. There's side effects from the medicine itself, and there's side effects again because it's involving our immune system. So our body is going to be like, hey, what's going on? So we're going to start having other immune related, like colitis, pneumonitis is a big one, and myocarditis, like all like these endocrine problems too. But the treatment itself can cause like fatigue most commonly, musculoskeletal pain, and diarrhea. Also, definitely, you cannot do it if you're trying to get pregnant, for sure. Women must use the contraception during and at least 3 to 5 months after the treatment. No breastfeeding while you're taking the medicine and 3 to 5 months after. And again, here, we cannot use it, unfortunately, for the organ transplant patients. So these are what we can use when you cannot use your elegant immunotherapy. So EGFR inhibitors like cetuximab, this is what our patient's going to be on. And then the other chemotherapy, none of these are FDA approved though. Prevention, again, the nicotinamide, it will prevent some of the non-melanoma skin cancer. And acitretin, we can use it for the patient, but start like low doses for the organ transplant patient and slowly go up as much as they can tolerate. And basically the side effect is like the isotretinoin. So if they're not dry, they're fine, and all of the side effects that we know from isotretinoin, we can go up to 20 milligrams. Okay, switching gears again, melanoma. Whew, okay. So in 2022, per the American Cancer Society, about almost 100,000 new melanomas will be diagnosed like in the next 2 months, okay, for this whole year. About almost 8,000 people are expected to die from this melanoma. Lifetime risk, I think it's very important. So most likely is the Caucasian, there's 2.6%. Hispanic, a bit less, like 0.6% chance that they will get a melanoma. And African American, a bit less, which is 0.1%. Now, this is a very interesting study. Here, they're showing us the incidence rate is increasing, but the mortality is really not. It's a little bit increased in older white males, but for the most part, as you can see, it's not. So are we over-diagnosing it? Maybe. But just know this. I thought it was very interesting. And who gets it? So it only accounts for 1% of the skin cancer, but it causes the death most likely out of all the skin cancers. And the interesting thing here is the median age is 65, but it is the number one cancer in patients between the age of 25 to 29. That sucks. That absolutely sucks. Now, the risk factors, again, are fair patients. A lot of the ultraviolet radiation, tanning beds 100%, high socioeconomic status, immune suppressant. Again, like we know, basal cell, squamous cell, and even melanoma, there's a 3 to 4-fold higher risk. Environmental exposure, family history. So there is like some genes that are in the family and that you need to ask a bit more questions because they could be related to also pancreatic cancer. So in the most the likely gene in the familial melanoma is the CDKN2A. Patients who have like a lot of moles, particularly atypical moles, those large moles, so those also you need to be cautious about. My way with these patients is I do a lot of photos. I take photos. I ask the patient to take photos because it's, sometimes it's really hard to keep up. Like the patient will never know. Like, is it changing? Is it new? Like, they're like, they don't know. And sometimes, yes, we can use all of those ways that they that can help us. This the ugly duckling sign or the ABCDE. But sometimes there are certain patients that are very, very hard for me to examine. So I take photos. It's in their medical records, and we compare photos. I ask the patient to do the same thing. I actually do it also for my husband. My husband, I do a lot of things on him. Whoever heard the Botox lecture. So we have photos and we compare. Okay, the major subtypes are 4. Superficial spreading, nodular, lenticular malignant melanoma, and acral ones. So let's talk about the superficial. This is the most common one. This is the one that I truly see most in our clinic. And it's highly curable because most likely they're caught early enough and the depth, because the melanoma, the depth. So it's the vertical growth that's important, not truly the horizontal. So when it start going down to the dermis, this is when I was like, okay, trouble, trouble, trouble. So the superficial spreading, just with the name, it's usually it goes like horizontal, not really the vertical. And most likely, it's associated with the pre-existing nevus. So most melanomas, they actually just occur out of nowhere. It's not like, oh, a mole that is changing. No, it's just like a completely new one. But with the superficial spreading, it's like one of those that, okay, they had a pre-existing nevus and now it's changing. And it can happen anywhere, but the high risk areas are back of both men and women, and then thighs of women. So just double check those areas when you do your skin checks. Now, nodular is the second most common. It accounts for 15 to 30% of all melanoma. And it's like this, like it looks like a dark pigmented. Sometimes it's like pedunculated. And it has a uniform color sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't. So to me, I do not like this ABCDE thing because not all of the melanomas are dark or more than 6 millimeter. I can't tell you how many melanomas I've done that's only 1 millimeter. I was like, good for your dermatologist who caught this. It's like nothing. It's super tiny. So for me, the important thing is it new? Is it changing? Is it giving you trouble? And by trouble, I mean, is it itching? Is it painful? Is it bleeding? Any of those, this is coming out. And I don't tell the patient, hey, let's monitor, come back. I was like, nope, it's coming out now. Okay, for the lenticular malignant melanoma, it accounts for 10 to 15% of all melanomas. And this is the one that arises in chronically sun-damaged areas. I'll tell you, this is super tricky to treat. So when I have those patients, those are one of my patients that I actually don't close when I remove it. So I take my margins, which we'll talk about, and I actually put zero foam, which is gauze with Vaseline. I put it there, and everything is oriented. It goes to the lab, and I just ask them to check all the margins. And I'll tell you, a lot of the times it comes back that they're still positive. So this is the one that goes on and on and on. And there's one patient that I'm thinking about now was on the temple. I hit the temporal nerve, and I told the patient, I was like, hey, it's there. You're not going to raise your eyebrow, but I got you. I'll start using Botox on the other side. He was like, go for it. So he comes now to do Botox on the other side. Sometimes we need to do that. So again, it's that sun-damaged area. It's nasty, and sometimes it's so hard to tell like where it starts and where it ends. And these cases, I actually always use my Woods lamp. Woods lamp is so nice. Oh, I have 10 minutes? No way, I'm having so much fun. Let's go. Okay. Really? Okay. acromelanoma, really nasty, very, very also hard to treat. A lot of the times they are actually amputated. And this is the most common skin cancer in skin of color. Okay, melanoma. Oh my goodness, I want to spend more time here. But basically with the melanoma, there is this MAPK pathway. So most likely it's the BRAF and the NRAS that's involved. And it's important because some of the medications are actually attacking these two areas. Staging, the most common in us in our dermatology world, we're in the T1 zone, which is great, which is great. When do we do sentinel lymph nodes? And here I'm going to just highlight the important things. So all the patients who have a T2A, and basically I'm going to go back. So the T2A is when it's more than 1 millimeter in depth, the breast low. All of those patients, it's like not even an option. They are getting a sentinel lymph nodes. Anything before that, you can consider it. And I surely did consider it on patients who comes to me like in their 20s. I was like, oh, I want you to live for 50 more years, if not more, and no, more than that. And then we're going to do what we're going to be as aggressive as possible to get rid of it. Okay, we can do some imaging when needed. These are all the different imaging, and I'll show you what when we do it. So imaging, really, when we're talking about the like the stage 3 and beyond, and basically this is that, again, not the dermatology world. Those are what's going to go to our oncology colleague. But the end, if you're going to do the imaging, these are the ones that we usually do. And this is the TNM staging that's also going to help figure out what we need to do. But basically what we, again, in dermatologists, we do, like we're all like above the T2 and above. Now, here are the important ones. The wide local excision in situ, we need to do 0.5 to 1 centimeter. And I'm just going to highlight a few things here. We usually always did 0.5, but now we have recent studies to support that it's not enough for the head and neck. So if I can do 1 centimeter, I usually go to 1 centimeter. And now you have all the other measurements depending on the breast low. But usually, again, in our world, I'm not doing more than 1 centimeter. The recurrence after wide local recurrence, you can see the numbers here, so not the greatest. So now we're starting to do like what basically Mohs or slow Mohs, and you can see the recurrence rate, how much lower it is. But I don't do it myself. It needs a lot of training. It needs special staining that is not that easy to do, to be honest. But I'm actually really interested in it, and I'm going to get a bit more training on that. And timing is key. Once you diagnose it, please like make sure it's going to be cut on like less than 30 days. And we have a study to show that the stage 1 disease, there's a higher mortality if we don't do it before the 30-day period, but not so often for stage 2 or 3. Okay, and now I'm going to skip the familial one. The immunotherapy here for melanoma, again, now we know the PD-1, so there's Pembro and the Nivo. Again, now you know how this works, which is super cool. The other one is the CTLA-4 inhibitor. Basically, it's kind of similar. So this is when the CTLA-4 is attached to the BC7. Again, nasty, nasty tumors. The T-cell is sleeping there. So you just do the inhibition between these two, and bam, the T-cell is awake again. The BRAF and the MEK inhibitors are also very effective. Usually you see the response even sooner than the immunotherapy. Okay, and these are the different regimens. So you can combine some of these together. Okay, I'm going to skip through these. Okay, now we're going to fly through these. DFSP. It's a low and intermediate grade sarcoma, usually patients in their 30s, usually on the trunk. Really, a lot of the times they're misdiagnosed as either cysts or keloids. So just remember, anything that looks a bit odd and now it looks like multinodular, stop, biopsy. Your biopsy has to be deep. You need to go deep. If you want to do 2 punches on top of each other, 1 is 6, 1 is 4, you can do that, or do an excisional biopsy, whatever you can, but we need like really deep, deep, deep. Really high recurrence rate, even after surgical excision. So I treat them with Mohs surgery. And even with Mohs surgery, I'm down to fascia, down to fascia. DFSP has like really, really nasty roots. So there, but again, the chances of it metastasizing is so rare. However, some of the DFSP has fibrosarcomatous changes. This is now we're talking about intermediate. It occurs in 9 to 20% of the DFSP, definitely more aggressive, increased recurrence and metastasis rate there. Again, if you're going to do a wide local excision, you're going to cut way too wide, like 2 to 3 centimeter, and that is not small. We have adjuvant therapy, adjuvant therapy, but we also have a tyrosine kinase inhibitor called imatinib that you can use it for unresectable or recurrent. But the recurrence rate is actually the majority of them, well, you will know about it in the first 3 years. Miracle, oh my goodness. Okay, this really, really keeps me up at night. This is nasty. This is terrible. Very, very aggressive, usually in elderly, very rapidly growing. Patients who have a lot of UV exposure and immune suppressed, and 80% of cases, it has the Merkel cell polyomavirus there. If they don't have it, if they don't have the antibodies, it's actually a really bad sign. The wide local excision, 1 to 2 centimeter, also deep, or you can also do Mohs surgery. And sentinel lymph node is a must. So regardless of what house size, whatever, sentinel lymph node is a must in these Merkel cell carcinoma. And those are terrible. I have a patient that has like a huge lymphedema because all his lymph nodes were involved and are gone, and it's terrible. Okay, radiation. We have also immunotherapy right now for the Merkel cell carcinoma, but look at the 5-year survival ranges. It's not great. Like if it's a local disease, it's like in 60s to 80s. But if there's nodal, it's 39 to 62, and metastasis is like bam, it's like really terrible. And recurrence rate, you can see it there. And usually it's going to go to the nodes, but if it's going to any organs, usually it's going to the liver first. I'm sorry, I don't know why it doesn't say that, but this is the sebaceous carcinoma. We can get it on our eyes or anywhere else on the body. If it's around the eyes, this is like really the bad sign here. You need the biopsy here. Imaging, if it's around the eye, just make sure like if there's any abnormality with the eye movement, you're getting an MRI to check all like the muscles there. But if you're worried about node involvement, CT is your best friend there. Screening. So sebaceous carcinoma is really interesting. Patients are more prone to get colon cancer because it's related to a Muratore syndrome. So we have this Mayo Clinic Muratore screening. You can see it over here. Any patient that has score of 2 and more, they need like all like the workup. So at least the colonoscopy, but so much more. I have a patient that's now with oncology, and they're doing all of the screening for that. Again, we're gonna remove it. We do Mohs surgery there. EMPD, extramammary Paget, oh my goodness, it is like really one of the hardest things that we can treat. So for you, just please remember, anytime you have a rash in the genital area that is not responding to our normal medications, like if you think it's a fungal or like eczema or whatever it is, please biopsy it. And it's a rare disease, but it's nasty. And if it's caught early when it's smaller, at least it's more manageable than when they come to like really huge sizes. And there is a primary form and a secondary form. The secondary form is most likely related to an underlying cancer. So most likely a lower GI or the GU. So once we know, also they're getting like a full screening check. Diagnosis here, biopsy, you need to take more than one area because sometimes it's so hard to see like all these really beautiful skin, like the cells there, it's like pagetoid. So sometimes it's hard from one biopsy, but the more biopsy the pathologist has, the better they can figure out the diagnosis. So wide local excision? We do it more often than Mohs, but it's seriously, it's a terrible disease. Like it's really deforming down there. So sometimes we can consider something like radiotherapy, imiquimod, PDT. But I'll tell you, like it's not great. Like if you talk with any Mohs surgeon, they will tell you this is the worst thing that can come to us. This is it. MAC is also a very locally aggressive sweat duct carcinoma, usually in like younger middle-aged patients. And it's like this indurated, rubbery, firm, papular plaque. And usually the head and neck is the most common area. But the nice thing about it, at least it doesn't, like the risk of metastasizing is low. And it has this, like, I just like this pathology. Like you can see all these like beautiful cells there. Management, we do definitely Mohs surgery, but again, any surgery that you can check all the margins there. And radiation only if we cannot cut it out. AFX or atypical fibrosarcoma, a pleomorphic dermal sarcoma. So both of them are fibrohistic, mesenchymal in origin. Head and neck is like more common, usually elderly. We're getting there. And it's rapidly growing, and it happens in sun-damaged area. And the mutation P53 and the TERT, it's telling us there's a lot of UV damage there. So AFX is the better one. The DPS, it's usually the one that can recur more often than the AFX and can metastasize. Basically, it's much deeper than the AFX. We did it. So basically a crash course of everything that I learned in dermatology in 1 hour. Oh my God, thank you guys. And I'm ready for any questions.
All right, so we have run out of time, but there are some really great questions.
Sorry,
so
you guys, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you want to hang out and you're okay with it, Dr. Nawas, we can ask a few questions. All right, so do you ever use a hedgehog inhibitor off-label for young patients with numerous BCCs who don't have an obvious syndrome but likely have a PTCH1 mutation?
Yeah, okay. I will say yes, you definitely can. But I always involve our oncologists too. I have a patient who has a BAP1 mutation. Basically, they're not known to have a lot of basal cell. Usually they have more melanomas. But this patient has basal cell everywhere, and she refuses to get them surgically removed. I'm just looking to see if Dr. Rosen is here because she's a mutual patient. So she's one of those patients that she's on it, yes.
And for Vismo, if men cannot donate sperm for 3 months, should they also refrain from not attempting pregnancy for that long as well?
Yes.
Okay. How long do you extend treatment with vismodegib after a clinically resolving locally advanced BCC? If surgical correction is necessary, do you allow time to detect recurrence before repair after stopping the Vismo?
You know what? Do you mind if you repeat it again?
Yes. How long do you extend treatment with vismodegib after a clinically resolved locally advanced BCC?
Okay.
If surgical correction is necessary, for example, ectropion, do you allow time to detect recurrence before repair after stopping the Vismo?
I'll be honest. I don't have any patient personally on Vismo, so I don't know the correct answer to that. Usually the oncologists are dealing with these medications. But can you start weaning it like after they respond? Absolutely. But when exactly, I apologize, I don't know for the Vismo.
Okay. What do you look for when examining a lentigo maligna melanoma with a Wood's lamp?
Okay. So I really don't use my dermoscope. Oh, or Wood's lamp, you said. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wood's lamp. What you're going to do, definitely the room has to be absolutely black, and it will fluoresce like purple color. Like, you're going to know that this is not just your normal solar lentigo. It's just, like, way more bright. And it can, it's with actually with any of the melanoma. So I never excise the melanoma without doing a Wood's lamp. It can help me figure out the margins. But I will say, like, once they come to me, they're already biopsied. So sometimes you're just seeing the effect of the biopsy. But I'm still trying to see if there's any extension. Having said that, the lentigo maligna melanoma are sneaky. So, but anything that fluoresces, I go for it. But definitely, that's why we send it to pathology. Like, I just don't just depend on that.
Do you have an opinion on the Castle Biosciences for SCC and melanoma?
On the Castle? I'm sorry?
Yeah, the Castle Bioscience testing.
I don't, no.
Okay. Do you always biopsy for a BCC or SCC? A dermatologist I work with will just topically treat for a few months without a biopsy, and if it's not better, then he will send for Mohs. What are your thoughts?
Oh my goodness, I'm not happy. Oh no. Okay, out of respect to all our colleagues here, definitely biopsy. Now we know, like, all like the subtypes have like a different endpoint. So I am not a fan of topicals. I don't do any topical or EDNC, the electrodesiccation curettage. Maybe because I'm a surgeon, I want to know the margins. So I never do any of that. I always biopsy and then do the right treatment afterwards. Yeah, but I respect everybody.
What's your recommendation for older patients who develop several SCCs? When do you involve oncology?
Yeah, it's actually really not easy. And I have a lot of these patients, unfortunately. So I talk to them a lot. And I always tell them, like, surgery is the best cure with any of these treatments. But then sometimes it's not realistic. It's not. Like the one that I mentioned, the one on the leg. Like, I think I would have caused a lot of morbidity with just the lidocaine alone. So I talk to them, I tell them everything, and I actually always involve the patient's family. So I was like, hey, come on, this is what we're going to talk about. And a lot of the time, I will send them to radiology or radiation oncologists, and they actually do pretty well. Like, they do pretty well. And a lot of times when these patients come to me, they just want to feel better and live a better life. Because when they get so big or so many of them, a lot of them, they have like this purulent discharge that just makes everyday's life not easy. So, yeah.
And one more here. Do you recommend nicotinamide in young patients with tanning bed history? Any counseling for patients when advising this?
I'm just so mad whoever is using the tanning beds. Like, it's not going to harm. It's like a vitamin B3 at the end of the day. It's not going to harm. So, like, if we can do anything to decrease the chances of them getting a cancer, absolutely do it. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Nawaz.
Thank you, you guys, so very much. I appreciate you.